For roughly 400 years, the Israelites had been in Egypt, and we probably all are familiar with the account how they had originally moved there to survive a great famine, but because Joseph had favor of Pharaoh, they stayed. But in the course of time, Joseph, of course, died, the Pharaonic dynasty changed, and Israel became slave labor for the benefit of the Egyptians and the new Pharaoh. They, of course, began to groan under this oppression. The centuries passed, God moved to free the Israelites for a variety of reasons, but primarily to begin to fulfill his covenant to Abraham, but also to begin to reveal his plan of salvation through his holy days. And as we rehearsed a week or so ago, on the night that God killed the firstborn of all Egypt, he had Israel take some of the blood of that lamb they were going to eat that evening, that was sacrificed for them, paint some of that on their doorposts, the lintel outside their homes, their very meager homes, and they were to stay indoors that whole evening. They were to eat that lamb with unleavened bread, with bitter herbs, a special meal that God had, as a reminder that God had brought them out, or was bringing them out of the land of Egypt, and that he was going to do that with a final plague of death upon the land. So he passed over them, as we've rehearsed. He passed over them as they heard the cries of the families of Egypt as they discovered their dead through the course of the evening, the night. And the next morning then brought the beginning reality of the freedom they would have. Not only were they going to be leaving Egypt, but their former taskmasters, those that benefited from them being slaves, were practically begging them to leave Egypt before God killed all in the land. During the daylight portion of that day, then, after the Passover, the Israelites collected their belongings. They collected the items that was actually payment for slavery from the Egyptians. They quickly made some more bread without leavening, and they had one last meal that night in Egypt, the beginning of the days of unleavened bread, a night we call the night to be much observed, or a date of solemn observance. The next morning, then, the first day of what God named the Days of Unleavened Bread, Israel gathered as a nation outside of Ramesses. The young and the old, all their livestock, the draft animals to pull the carts that would carry the young and the very old, the weak, they all assembled. They even gathered the bones of Joseph as they remembered the promise that he had asked them to make to not leave his bones there. And once everything was set, they moved out as a nation with God leading them during the day with a cloud that would protect them from the brutal sun and at night with fire that would warm them in the cold of the desert. On their way out of Ramesses, they could see all the Egyptians burying their dead. And Israel began to leave Egypt. Then on that first day of unleavened bread, interestingly, in ways of connection, they traveled to Sukkoth, which we observe the end of the year. On the second day of unleavened bread, they moved from Sukkoth to Itham, and I can imagine that their spirits were very high as they had visions of returning to the land God had promised to Abraham. The next day was the weekly Sabbath. Moses spent that day preaching to the group, the nation of Israel, and they realized very quickly, though, that God was not done with Egypt. He had Moses and Israel backtrack what seemingly, as Pharaoh said, they're lost. It looked like they were lost. They backtracked to a place called Pi-Hahiroth. They camped at Migdol, which brought them near the Red Sea. God did this, as I mentioned, so that Pharaoh would think they had lost their way, and as they realized the loss of the slave labor, Pharaoh and his armies decided that they would correct this mistake before the Israelites got too far away. God had not led Israel along the coast, which is a much shorter distance to the promised land. He did so because of the Philistines in the area. He didn't want to overwhelm the nation to begin with. So he led them to a spot along the Red Sea that would lead Pharaoh to believe that he could recapture them. And all of his army went out, foot soldiers, chariots, every man. He thought this would be an easy victory. After all, these were slaves. They had no weapons. They had no training. They had no understanding of war. But what was happening is that God wanted to completely break the power of Egypt. He had shown the land their gods were impotent and worthless. but they had not really learned the lesson. He was going to break them, so they couldn't bother Israel for a long, long time. Pharaoh, of course, could move his army more quickly than a nation of families moving animals and old people and such. And so Pharaoh caught up with the nation of Israel in just a few days, traveling what it took the nation 6 days to do. And so we come to the point of Israel seemingly trapped, the Red Sea in front of them, mountains on both sides, Pharaoh and his army behind them, literally trapped between rocks and a hard place. In short order, as we've rehearsed already today, the nation turned on Moses, claiming, illogically, that all he wanted to do was bring them out so they could be killed. But again, God had something different in mind. He was seeking to teach Israel, to show Israel just how powerful he is and how he would take care of them. He was beginning to develop a relationship with them that they had not really had for some 400 years. And so he encouraged the nation not to be afraid. He told them that God would fight for them. The timing of the week shows us that that day was this day in history, the last day of unleavened bread. Israel had the opportunity to show great faith in this circumstance. Instead, they showed great fear. And to some degree, this is understandable. Their relationship had been broken for centuries. They didn't have that intimate knowledge and relationship with him. But they had also witnessed great miracles and plagues that were inflicted upon the Egyptians. But in this moment, they were weak. They were only seeing things through human eyes, and they were afraid, in spite of, as we have already heard today, God's promise that he would fight for them. The topic of faith is one of those biblical topics that has been discussed at great length, and yet it can still leave us wanting more understanding. What is faith? It is certainly trusting in God, it's steadfastness, it's a surrendering of our will, it's many, many things, even that we heard of today earlier. Hebrews 11 even records many examples of individuals that we know and recognize as living lives of great faith, individuals like Noah and Abraham and Moses and Rahab and Gideon and many others. But we also have many recorded in Scripture that are not recorded in that book. Individuals like Joshua and David and Isaiah, Daniel, and many others. But the question remains, how do we have the faith like those men and women? What did those individuals have beyond the aspects of faith I just mentioned? I believe one major aspect of our walk in faith that is not talked about very often or very much is the very human tendency to be afraid. But what does this have to do with us being here today, this last day of unleavened bread? Well, it has everything to do with it. Because in our walk to come out of sin, we cannot be afraid. Can't have fear. Now, God doesn't cause us to fear, but he can allow situations where we might be afraid. In part, one aspect of which he allows this is for us to learn to truly trust him, that he will deliver us from sin, that he will deliver us from times of trouble, that he will lead us to eternal life and bring us to a place of having no fear, spiritually speaking, in order for us to be in his kingdom. And that's what we're going to explore today. The connection between having no fear and having complete faith in God. So the title of my message today is Fear versus Faith. Let's turn to Exodus 14, where much of the account that I summarized in my introduction is recorded for us. Exodus 14 and then verse 13. Moses said to the people, "Do not be afraid." And it seems to be an obvious thing that we say, right? In the midst of these things, and it always seems disingenuous. In times it actually seems like provocation. You're in the middle of something and somebody says, "Well, just don't be afraid." What are you going to do? Does the fear automatically go away? It often deepens. But he's telling him, reminding him here, "You have no reason to fear," he says. "Stand still and see the salvation of the Eternal." And even that goes counter to our human tendencies, to stand still in the midst of trouble. We're looking to run away. We're looking to get someplace safe. We're looking for it to be over with. But he says, stand still. God will accomplish for you today these things. For the Egyptians who you see today, you will see again no more forever. And again, from a human perspective, what does that mean? You have no idea that it's literally going to mean forever. Right? These people died without ever seeing the Egyptians again. But was that metaphorical or was it literal? They don't know. They don't have a perspective, right? But the word here for fear is the word in Hebrew, yare, and it does mean that, literally, fear. It's used some 300 times in the Old Testament. This is a topic that's touched on regularly in Scripture, not just only in the Old Testament. And I find it notable that this concept of fear is talked about so much. Again, we find the word fear, but we find other aspects, other phrasings, if you will. Do not fear. That's mentioned roughly 60 or more times. Do not be dismayed. That's touched on about 30 different times in the Old Testament. But we even find God oftentimes addressing the concept of fear with those he's working with. We heard about that this morning. Matthew 6, verse 25. Don't be afraid. We find it in the example of even Joshua. As Israel moved through the 40 years of wandering, as they got close to the end, in Deuteronomy 31, twice in that chapter, Moses tells Joshua himself, be strong and of good courage. Which means he probably was not strong or had courage. But Moses is encouraging him here. And then God does the same thing. In the beginning chapter of Joshua, there's three times God tells Joshua to be strong and of good courage. And then later, Joshua even says that to the nation in Joshua 10. But let's go next to 1 John 4 and contrast this with a verse that seems to put us at odds with ourselves. 1 John 4. And in verse 18, the Apostle John writes this here. He says, there is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear, because fear involves torment. But he who has fear has not been made perfect in love. So in my college education, my theology degree, one of the requirements was speech class. And I'm not sure, I think it was my sophomore year in college, the instructor that I had, some of you might remember this name, Mr. Dick Ames, he would oftentimes quote this verse, that we were fearful as public speakers because we didn't have perfect love. Having the benefit of decades of being able to look back on that and realizing he was probably being cheeky with us. But the point kind of stuck, because I don't remember any of my other instructors. I remember him. But even this is interesting. In this verse, the word fear here in the Greek is the word phobos. Does that sound familiar? We get our English word phobia, the Greek word phobia, from it. And it literally means to have a fear, doesn't it? It's used roughly 47 or so times in the New Testament. And so we find that we need to distinguish between godly fear and human fear. Let's go back a little bit to Hebrews 11. I mentioned this in my introduction. And let's just consider one example in this chapter. Hebrews 11. Of course, it's not a complete list, as I mentioned. Many names here that are not mentioned. But we have a listing of certain individuals and things that we should learn from them, the benefit of what they went through. In Hebrews 11 and verse 7, we read here of Moses. And as Paul writes, he says, by faith Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen. Who had ever seen a flood? There are many that say that the water cycle did not function the way we're familiar with today, meaning there's a great canopy over the earth. You read of this back in Genesis, and it seems that perhaps the earth was watered by dew, not so much rain. You can have heavy dews. Plants can thrive in that environment. If they had never seen a flood before, what does a ship of this size mean? It probably looked ridiculous to them. But it says Moses was moved. It says with godly fear. He didn't understand. But as it says back in Genesis, one of my great familiar or motivating verses is that Moses did. Even if he didn't understand, he did. And notice why, what happened here. It says, prepared an ark for the saving of his household, by which he condemned the world. How did he condemn them? I don't think so much through what he preached for 120 years. It was more in what he did. He condemned them. They ended up being wrong, very wrong, costing their lives, didn't it? I've even heard some speculate, if you ever go back and do a study on the ark itself, many people say, well, not everything could have fit in there. Well, they're confusing things. You only need one type of dog. You don't need every type of dog. Through breeding, they become these other types of dogs. Same thing with horses and cattle and all kinds of animals. Moses could have even, or Noah could have even been moved to get infant animals, right? So they would not have taken up as much space. There are a variety of things. So even if one level of the ark was for these animals, one level of ark was for food and Noah's family, it would have left a whole level empty, which to me makes sense. Because what if Noah had preached and there was no room and someone listened? Well, I'm sorry, you got to go build your own boat. I think part of the condemnation was the fact that he did do these things. But notice back in the early part of the verse, he moved with godly fear. So what is the difference? The difference between human fear and godly fear is that human fear worries and acts negatively against the unknown. It's our natural reaction. Right, we worry about the uncertain, we worry about the overwhelming, we worry. But worry doesn't change anything, does it? Godly fear rests in the certainty of him being in control and us acting accordingly. And doing so, we can be part of what he is working out. Let's go back to 1 Kings 19. In 1 Kings 18, we have the account recorded for us, you might remember, of the prophet Elijah. And it's Elijah's an interesting story because he sort of almost bursts on the scene. We don't really have an introduction to him. And God uses him very powerfully in what seems to be perhaps a very short ministry. But in that chapter, he confronts the prophets of Baal, and by extension, Ahab, king of Israel, in this great showdown on Mount Carmel. You're probably very familiar with that account. And he sort of leads them on, right? He gives them a challenge, whose God can consume the offering. And they put their offering on their altar, and they go through all these machinations, right? They're cutting themselves, they're chanting probably until they're hoarse. They're dancing around in a frenzy, doing all these things, and he just keeps teasing them. Well, maybe he can't hear you. Maybe he's gone away. Maybe he's using the bathroom. You need to yell louder. So they go through all that, and it comes his turn. And if you remember the account, this is a time of famine. It's been a famine for 3 years, a drought. And so he has them soak the altar, not once, not twice, three times. Everything's saturated. And then he prays a prayer that you could probably say in less than 30 seconds. And God responds. And the fire comes down, and it not only consumes the offering, it consumes the altar, it consumes the water, everything's gone. And so then Elijah seizes the opportunity and tells Israel, who are you going to serve? And he tells them to kill all the priests of Baal, some 400 individuals. King Ahab was a weak king, deeply influenced in a very wrong way by his pagan wife, Jezebel. And when Jezebel hears about it, you can imagine she's very unhappy. And she is determined. She says to Elijah, I'm going to kill you. And what does Elijah do then? He doesn't go and pray to God. He doesn't ask. He doesn't do a lot of things that we might think that he does. He runs. Not only does he run, he runs. If you look at a Bible atlas, it's more than 100 miles. I mean, he's getting not only out of town, out of country. He thinks the further away he gets, the better it's going to be. And so we come to chapter 19, 1 Kings, and then in verse 3, God asks, well, Elijah then responds. This is the reaction to Jezebel. He goes all the way south. Verse 4, he went a day's journey into the wilderness. So this is the wilderness south of the area we call Judea. He comes, he sits down in a broom tree, he prayed that he might die. Not that God would strengthen him, not that God would show him, not that God would fight this battle for him. He's given up. He says, it's enough, take my life, I'm no better than my father's. As he lay and slept under a broom tree, suddenly an angel touched him and said to him, arise and eat. And we find God's mercy and patience even in these circumstances. And I've somewhat jokingly said that if you ever find yourself in the midst of a trial that seems as overwhelming as what Elijah was facing here, take a nap, have something to eat. Because you're not thinking right, right? You need a perspective. And so he sends an angel to feed Elijah. He looked, and there by his head was a cake baked on coals, a jar of water. He ate and drank. He lay down. He did it again. God sent an angel a second time. Same thing. He rose, he ate. And then he went on the strength of that, verse 8, another 40 days and 40 nights down to Mount Horeb. So he finds a cave there, verse 9. He goes into the cave. He spent a night there. And then God comes to him and he says, what are you doing here? And Elijah probably thought that was one of the most ridiculous questions in the world to ask. And notice how he responds. He's justifying his fear. He says, I've been very zealous for the eternal of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant. They've torn down your altars. They've killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life. What are you doing, God? Do you not see what I'm going through here? And so then God goes through this point of illustrating to Elijah. He's got the wrong perspective. He goes out, stands in the mouth of this cave, and this great earthquake comes as God passes. And then there's a great fire that comes. And Elijah's standing there, and the voice says again to him, verse 13, why are you here? What are you doing here? I believe the question is trying to refocus Elijah. God knows what's going on, but Elijah wasn't seeing what God was doing. All he was seeing was the trouble in front of him. And so he says the same thing back to him. I'm the only one left. Your people have forsaken your law. They've killed your prophets. I'm the only one left. And so then we come to verse 15, and God simply says, go on your way and return to Damascus. I've got work for you to do. Because God showed Elijah it wasn't going to be in powerful things like an earthquake or a fire. It was the still voice. He says, I understand how you feel, but we have work to do. Verse 18, he also tells him, I reserved 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed to Baal, every mouth that has not kissed him. Elijah didn't even have a full picture of the account in the land of who still worshiped God. Let's go next to Luke chapter 12. Human fear comes from this uncertainty that I mentioned. And to a degree, to be fair, it's understandable. Because we're human, we focus on the physical, what we can see, what we can feel, what we can taste, all these things. And when we don't have those things, we get very unnerved. Right? You go jump in deep water in the ocean, you don't know what's under there. Right, you go someplace that's brand new to you, and you're confused, you're uncertain. It's very unsettling, isn't it? In Luke 12 and verse 4, we have another perspective that Christ here is teaching, because he's talking about fear. So he says, speaking to the multitude and the disciples here, he says, I say to you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who can kill the body. And I can imagine them reacting, at least in their minds, by saying, are you kidding me? Why would I not fear that? But here's the perspective, he says. If they do that, there's no more they can do to you. Most people don't find that very comforting. But when you're dead, you're dead, right? You can't feel pain. You can't suffer. You can't, all these worries, none of that's there. Verse 5, he says, but I will show who you should fear. And it's that word, phobos. Fear him who after he has killed has the power to cast you into Hades. Yes, I say to you, fear him. So he's speaking of God. So again, should we fear God? Are we talking about uncertainty? No, we're talking about consequence. Fear what God can do, not who he is. God can permanently remove our life. Men can only do it temporarily. That alone should give us a different perspective. But again, humanly, how do we get to a point of having faith like Elijah? Elijah had faith. He's mentioned in the Jewish community, he's mentioned quite highly. We'll come to this in a moment. We can look at men like Moses, Noah, Abraham. They had great faith, but they also had great times of fear, didn't they? Well, let's go back to Hebrews 5, and let's look at this aspect of godly fear again. Hebrews 5 and in verse 7, Paul here is talking about how Christ has become our spiritual high priest, how he fulfilled the office, if you will, of Melchizedek mentioned back in Genesis. And so he's speaking about Christ as Melchizedek, verse 7, he says, who in the days of his flesh, again, speaking of Christ, when Christ was a physical man, he said he'd offered up prayers and supplications with vehement cries and tears to him who was able to save him, to the point where he sweat blood. Right? That's overwhelming. We don't do that naturally. It would be very unnerving to even see it happening. But this was to the extent that he was submitting himself, the stress that he was under. It says, he did this to him who was able to save him from death. Not the death on the cross, eternal death. Because he knew he was going to die on that cross. That's why he came. He came to be our Passover lamb, sacrificed for us. He came to die after living a sinless life so we could have the Holy Spirit, so we could have salvation. But notice these prayers were heard because of his godly fear. The Young's literal translation has that translated to that which he feared. He submitted himself to what he feared. And the NIV has it that he heard, God heard because of his, Christ's, reverent submission. How was Jesus Christ able to be without sin, to willingly die in our place as our sin sacrifice, to pray not to protect his human life, but to have his glory again and to be heard by the Father? What was different? We come down to vision. Let's keep that in mind as we go back to Acts 7. We have the account in Acts 7 of the deacon Stephen being stoned. I grew up with four brothers. Occasionally we would stone each other. We played with rocks. Even in the wintertime, we would oftentimes pack snowballs around a stone. You get a double tap out of those things. But that's not what's being talked about with stoning. I mean, those might leave a small bruise. Stoning broke bones. It broke flesh. It killed people. These are rocks big enough you have to heave. And here's Stephen going through this account of Israel's history, and then he brings it down to a personal level, and they are very angry at him because they don't want to hear this, right? Personal accountability is a rare thing for someone to see and to have. And so picking up the story in verse 54, when they heard these things, they were cut to the heart, right? They didn't know what to do. And I've often said, it's been an observation of mine, that when someone does not know what to do, that's when you see the character they have. Because they're either going to get humble or they're going to get angry. And when they get angry, you don't know what they're going to do. But it says here, Verse 55, he, Stephen, being full of the Holy Spirit, gazed into heaven, and God gave him a vision here. It says that he saw the glory of God and Jesus standing at the right hand of God, and he says this to them, look, I see the heavens opened, and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God. And they cried out with a loud voice, stopped their ears, ran at him in unison. They cast him out of the city, and they stoned him. And Paul's introduced here, who still had the name Saul. But notice what he does at the very end, verse 60, as he knelt down, as he was having to kneel down, being pummeled with these rocks, he says to God with a loud voice, not quietly, do not charge them with this sin. And then he died. How does a person go through an event like this and still remain at peace? It comes back to vision. We find this in Proverbs 29. Vision is critical in life. I am convinced to a great degree of the problems in the Western nations, especially that we have those problems because there is no vision. There's no vision of a future. There's no vision of a government that works. There's no vision of being part of something bigger. There's no vision for the future. And so all you have to think about is the now. And then you begin to think about how the now is not fair. And all that you don't have. And then you get really angry. In Proverbs 29, verse 18, this is the New King James. It says, where there is no revelation, the people cast off restraint, but happy is him who keeps the law. In the King James Version, it says, where there is no vision. Right? That you have this picture in your mind of something bigger. There have been studies that have been done on individuals we call prisoners of war, right? Soldiers captured by armies. And especially in the modern era, those camps, if you will, those prisons are usually not really good places at all. Very brutal. And so why does one person, quote unquote, thrive, meaning they live through it and they still function? They still have a life. And why do other people's die? Even if they don't physically die, many will take their lives rather than deal with this. But even if they don't physically die, it's like they're broken the rest of their life. What's the difference between the two? And they come down to this point. They have a vision of something bigger. No matter the circumstances I'm in now, when I get out of here, I'm going to do, and they have a vision. What's the vision we should have? What's the vision you have? Because we can get stuck in fear. And again, like the Israelites, looking at that huge body of water in front of them, we may not know what to do. It may look insurmountable. It may look like we have no options. Where is God? If we have a good vision of what God is working out in our lives, then we'll see that God is in charge, that he controls everything. And no matter the circumstances, no matter the outcome in our life, we know with confidence he is working out his purpose of plan and salvation, not only for all of mankind, but even us individually. And that if we yield to him, ours is his kingdom. Right? That's the vision. So everything in between is simply something to go through to get there. That's different than facing or looking at everything as a huge obstacle. How am I going to get by this? How am I going to go through this? Why is this happening? And we get stuck in these loops of thinking and we don't progress. Let's go forward a little bit to Isaiah chapter 12. Isaiah 12 and in verse 2. This short chapter is a chapter of praising God. And in verse 2, Isaiah records here, behold, my God is my salvation. I will trust and not be afraid. For Yah, the Eternal, is my strength and song. He has also become my salvation. And I find this interesting to ponder because usually the human reaction when we face difficult times is we try to fix it. And then we get scared that we can't or that it won't change. And yet here we're to acknowledge, who is our strength? God. We don't have to do most of what we try to do in our calling because we're trying to do it ourselves. If we trust God to be the strength we need, then we can actually relax and have confidence because we know no matter how long it takes, no matter the way it goes, whatever the outcome is, that God is there. His purpose is being worked out, even for us individually. And that if we do this, then he becomes our salvation. Now, as we heard earlier today, we have to do our part. We have to be engaged. And in the midst of trials, I think it was Churchill that said, if you're in life and you find yourself in hell, keep going. Don't stop. Keep going. It doesn't do any good to stop because you're just going to be immersed in it. It will never change. Keep going. Let's go back to Psalm 57. Psalm 57, and in verse 1, David writes here, be merciful to me, O God, be merciful to me, for my soul trusts you. That is an ongoing aspect of our relationship, isn't it? And that we'll see at times we think we trust God, we say we trust God, and we'll be faced with something, and then we'll realize there's more that we need to know or understand or have. But to not give up on that. I've seen people broken. I still remember a family in Cincinnati decades ago, and it seemed that their family had faced one major health crisis after another, and some of the family members had actually died. And yet another family member faced something overwhelming, and I remember my parents stopping after services one day to visit with the family, and as I was listening to some of the conversations, one of the family members says, I'm done. Right? It had gotten to a point in their mind, nothing was changing, everything was just getting worse, this was not going to change, and so she was done. Well, what did that fix? Nothing. She left. The family left. They had stopped trusting God. They were only seeing what was in front of them, like the Israelites. But notice the rest. He says, in the shadow of your wings, I will make my refuge. Right? That God will figuratively put his arms around us. It doesn't mean that we don't face hard things in life. I've lost at least 3 jobs over the Sabbath. 2 over the holy days, 1 was combined. I got in trouble because I was keeping the Sabbath, and then when I went to the holy days, they said, that's it. In every case, I had no idea what I was going to do after that. On one occasion, the last one happened, coming back from the feast and losing the job, that our twins had to face their surgery. We knew they needed surgery. I have no job. And yet we needed insurance. There was no way I could pay for those surgeries, even if I had a job. But to see God's hand in these things, the short story is he did protect us. The job I got out of that, when I was hired, the man that I worked for was probably the best job boss I had in my career, that career. And he was very pro-family. And he decided, as a blessing to me, that he would predate my insurance. So the day I started work, I had insurance. But here's how God can do things in irony. Because we had cobra'd the insurance, if you know what that is, right? So I had been able to continue the insurance coverage by paying for it myself. But because I had cobra'd it, the surgeries went under the previous employer. Those surgeries combined were probably close to at least $300,000 or $400,000. And here's somebody who fired me over the holy days and now having to take it on the chin, if you will. I'm sure that changed his premiums. And I hope that all of us could have stories like that, to be reminded of how God will put his arms around us, that we can take refuge in the shadow of his wings until calamities pass. That we don't have to fear these circumstances, as uncomfortable as they may be, as uncertain as they may be. Israel had great fear, and we can point the finger and we can condemn them for it, but we need to make sure that we're not following the wrong example. Because they were seemingly pinned down, weren't they? And they're told to stand still. Just hold on, and God will deliver you. When humanly, there is no reason to expect that to be the case. 3 million or whatever the number was, people, they can't climb over the mountains, get away quickly. They can't go back the other way. They'll run into the buzzsaw. And they're not in Wisconsin, so they can't walk across the water. And yet God showed them deliverance, didn't he? And yet he still had to nudge them, kick them in the rear a little bit, because even after he'd parted the water and dried the land out to make it easy for them to walk across, they're standing there and God says to Moses, again, we rehearsed this morning, stop whining, go, move. We read briefly the account of Elijah, his overwhelming fear of Jezebel. He feared, at that point, he feared Jezebel more than God. Jezebel was an awful, evil woman. And humanly, he had reason to fear her. She would kill anybody that stood in her way. But running more than 100 miles doesn't solve the problem. She's still there. And God simply asked Elijah, okay, he basically said, I understand, let's go back and do the things need to be done. And in doing so, he was showing Elijah he's still in charge, he's still working on his purpose. Stephen was able to die a martyr of stoning because he had something bigger in mind. And I can only imagine the pain that he was in as his body was literally being broken as he felt his life ebbing out of him. Jesus Christ was able to live a perfect sinless life because he didn't come to be a part of this world. He came with a different vision in mind. He came to be our sacrifice. He came to pave the way, if you will, for us to be part of their family. And in doing so, he was able to do those things because he yielded completely to God's will and had no fear. This past week, we symbolically represented walking out of spiritual Egypt, emulating the example of those Israelites, as we've heard, to begin the walk out. They saw the Egyptians no more after they went through the Red Sea. Pharaoh thought, well, that's convenient. I'll just chase them. And then they all died. When those waters crashed back together, they all died. But did that end Israel needing to walk out of Egypt? It didn't. They still had to face their own carnality. They still had to face their own fears. They still needed to learn who Christ God was in the Old Testament, who he was, and what he was doing. But we are also to take that and to remember the faith that we're to have. The faith like Abraham and Moses, Joshua and Elijah and these other individuals, and especially the faith of Jesus Christ. It's his faith we need. These days of unleavened bread are used by God to reveal a part of his plan of salvation, the beginning part of it. It all starts with Jesus Christ. His sacrifice makes the rest of it possible. If he had not come and did what he did, we would have no salvation. The law is needed to show the standard, but God's Spirit is needed so that we have the empowerment to actually do it. But we rehearse these holy days now, this coming year, as they'll build on each other. With Christ having done his part, we can begin to walk out. We have to do our part. But we find in their example, it's limited, isn't it? How many times did they fear? They forgot God, and they had great fear at times. they would be regularly raided by these nations around them until they would finally remember there is a God. Maybe he'll listen to us if we go and plead with him, if we humble ourselves, and they would be delivered. And then, of course, in time, they would forget again and rinse and repeat. They did this for 400 years or more. But yet, still in God's mercy, he delivered them. He used them as an example, as we've read, to be reminded that we can't look at what's in front of us. We need to look at what God is offering. We see his plan of salvation then, and we rehearse it for us. Today is the day of judgment for God's people. We know we've been given his Spirit. Do we have the vision to see it through? That no matter what, I will not give up on that vision. I've had a few individuals ask me over the years as they counsel for baptism, well, how do I know I can do that? And I say, you don't. But you have to make the decision you're going to do it. Because we make those decisions all the time, even humanly. How do I know my marriage can last 50 years? I don't know. But you wake up every day saying, I'm going to. How do I know I'm going to finish college? You don't. But you get up every day saying, I want to finish this course. I want to get to this. We don't know a lot of things in life, but we still do them. Why is this any different? For a much bigger reward, if you will. We also know in looking at and rehearsing God's plan of salvation that God will also offer this to the balance of mankind. The world we see around us is not the world that's going to exist forever. It is just the temporary now because it needs to be. For us to see, for mankind to see what it is that God is offering, what he has done. Right? We have many of those accounts recorded for us. What he has done and what he has promised and why we can see that he will be faithful. Because he's always been. Is that part of your vision? Is it part of my vision? And it's not to say that we won't at times find ourselves full of fear. But that should be the reminder of why the vision is important. The short term will not last forever. Will we still be where we want to be in the end? God reveals his hand in our life time and time and time again, that we have him as a refuge, we have him as a strength, and that our vision is secure. Let's conclude then in Luke 12. Part of the fear that some can face sometimes, and that I'll hear occasionally, is that someone will say, hopefully I will be in God's kingdom. That should not be our vision. Our vision is, I will be in God's kingdom. Because the only one that will ensure that we're not there is us. And Luke 12 and verse 32, to break into a thought here, Christ is talking about, in this particular section of the chapter, this matter of worry, which is, again, fear. And he comes to verse 32, and he puts it to a point here. He says, do not fear, little flock. Right? We're tiny. The world doesn't even know we exist. At one point, they knew more of us, if you will. And maybe God will bring that back. I kind of doubt that he will, because it's not about numbers. It's about refinement at this point in my mind. So he says, even though you're little, don't fear. It's not about numbers with God. But notice what else he says. For it is your Father's good pleasure. He's not doing this reluctantly. He's not doing it because we do something he has to. It's his good pleasure. He desires this. This is his vision. His good pleasure to give you the kingdom. What would you pay for that? You could never pay for it. What would we give him that isn't already his? His desire is to give us his kingdom. We rehearse that this week by doing our part, by listening to the instruction, as we've heard, of applying the sacrifice of Christ in our life, yielding to him to work in our life so that we can have God's good pleasure of him giving us his kingdom. As we look forward in the coming year, as we rehearse the balance of the Holy Days one more time, as we face whatever we face in the coming year, may we have no fear, but rather great faith in God as we look forward to his kingdom.